choose? She smiled. It's something like the difference between being a lawyer and being a judge, or, as you put it, a caterpillar and a butterfly. She took a swallow of hot coffee. Putting yourself into someone else's shoes means stepping into their world, understanding their situation, what the stakes are for them, what's going on for them, what they're thinking, which is all important. But empathy isn't about thinking. Empathy takes it a giant step further. Empathy is feeling what the other person is feeling. Jackson thought about that for a moment. And tact? He asked. Tact is the ability to speak to that place, she replied, truthfully, yet at the same time with compassion. Tact is the act of giving empathy a voice, like setting a poem to music. In any exchange, business or personal, empathy is the single greatest determinant of success. Not only having empathy, but also communicating it. You'll come away from talking with such a person feeling as if you were the only other person in the world. That's because for those moments, to that person, you were the only other person in the world. Jackson knew exactly what she meant. Now that he thought about it, that's exactly how he felt every time he talked with her. Was it only Saturday that he'd been worried about divulging his problems to a perfect stranger? And now he felt like this person knew him better than just about anyone else on the planet. Except Keith, maybe. And Solomon, of course. "I don't know, Your Honor," he said. It was the first time he'd called her that, and she looked amused at the title. "Half the time I'm not even sure what I'm feeling. And I'm no mind reader. I think we've established that. How do you know what the other person is feeling?" "You may not," she replied. "The truth is, you can't always know. But even if you can't, here's the thing. You're both human beings." Jackson sighed. "The human being I'm meeting with tomorrow? I cannot figure her out." The judge reached out and placed her hand on Jackson's arm. "Jackson." He looked up at her. "Empathy isn't trying to figure someone out. It's not about reading the signs or analyzing the signals. Empathy is resonance." She sat back and took a slow sip of her coffee, once again watching him over the rim of her cup. "Do you know what I mean by that?"
"I think so," said Jackson.
"It's like," she began. She set her cup down and frowned for a moment and thought, then looked up at him. "It's like when you strike a chime, and a tuning fork tuned to the same precise frequency starts vibrating along with it. Or how you'll read something in a novel or hear something in a story that stirs your soul because it reminds you of someone you know or of something that happened to you once. Or how the face of someone you love somehow reminds you of who you are. Because they all resonate. And here's the secret, what lies at the core of the fourth clause. What lies at the core of all successful interaction of any kind. You resonate with everyone, no matter how different from you they may seem. Every person alive is a chime. Everyone is a tuning fork." She paused for a moment to let that sink in, then added, "Have you ever noticed how practically everyone loves dogs? Of course you have. You more than most. That's because they're such resonant creatures, so effortlessly empathetic." There was a silence. Then Jackson spoke up. "So you're saying I should try to be more like my dog?" She smiled, a serious sort of smile. "No, Jackson. I'm saying you are more like your dog. More than you know." "So, Jackie," said Walt, "tomorrow's the big day, huh?" Jackson shrugged. Amazing, they had gotten nearly all the way through dinner, and his father hadn't once brought up the subject of Jackson's business till now. Old man must be going soft. As if. "Listen," a jab in the air with the fork. "You just remember what I told you. The challenge. The takeaway. They'll drop like a sack of potatoes." Jackson looked bleak. "I don't know, Pop." Walt put his fork and knife down and looked at his son across the table. "These are good tips, son. Weapons honed in the crucible of battle.
Walt sat motionless for a moment, staring down at his hands. Then he let out a nearly inaudible sigh. "Though I have to admit, I can't say how they really worked out for me." Jackson looked up, startled. "Excuse me?" His father didn't look at him, just kept staring at his hands. His voice got softer as he spoke. "Oh, I closed deals. Lots of them. Lost a bunch, closed a bunch. But what did it get me? I mean," he paused as if groping for the right words, "I mean, when it's all said and done." "Pop." Jackson had no idea what to say. Walt looked up, and Jackson was horrified to see the man's eyes glistening. Walt never cried. As far as Jackson knew, the man had been born without tear ducts. "Did I ever tell you what your mother said?" said Walt, "the day she died?" All these years, and they'd never once talked about this. "No," said Jackson softly, "but I bet I can guess. She asked you to watch out for me, take care of me, make sure I was okay." Walt gave a short, derisive laugh. "Shows you how much you know." "No, son." He looked away. Then, still looking away, he kept talking. "No," he repeated. "She said, Walter, if you're ever in trouble, you just call Jackson. He'll know what to do." Jackson was stunned. "She said that? What did she mean?" Walt turned his gaze back to his son. "What do you think she meant?" "Just what she said. Exactly that." He turned away again, then added, "Grace knew her boy." Grace knew her boy. "Wait a minute," said Jackson. "What do you mean she knew her boy? Why would she tell you to call on me?" Walt looked back at him once more. "Why do you think?" Jackson honestly had no idea. I'm no kind of businessman, Pop." "Jackie, listen to me. You've got something you believe in. Doing something that makes a difference. You've got more going on for you than I ever did." He sat still for a moment, as if trying to put together one more sentence, but then deciding the best he could do was repeat one he'd already said. "You've got something you believe in, so don't forget that, okay?" And at that, he quietly got up and left the table. Jackson lay awake that night for hours. He couldn't stop thinking about what Walt had said, and his mother, Grace Hill, and what she told her husband about their boy, Jackson. Finally, he switched on his bedside lamp and sat up. He pulled out his little notebook, turned to the next blank page, and wrote, 4. Communicate with tact and empathy. Let yourself feel what the other person is feeling, and speak to that truthfully, yet also with compassion. No matter how different they may seem, or what position they may take, remember that they are a chime, and you are a tuning fork. He stared at the page. Then he slowly leafed through the previous few pages. Set the frame. Step into their shoes. Master your emotions. That was all very well, but he still didn't see how any of this was going to solve his situation. He closed the book and put it away. Bottom line, what Jillian Waters wanted and what he wanted, no, what he needed, were a pair of cross swords, as opposite as north and south. He could be as tactful and empathetic as the moon, but that wasn't going to get Smith and Banks to budge. And he needed them to. He needed to walk out of his meeting at Jillian Waters' office tomorrow with that contract in his hand, or he could kiss his business, his career, and his dreams goodbye.
Chapter 12. Trust. When Jillian showed up at the Juice Caboose on Friday morning, the coach took one look at her across the room and gestured for her to stay there, spoke a few words to the person at the order counter, then walked over to join her at the front door. "You're worried," he said. She nodded. He could see that from across the room. "About your meeting today?" She nodded again. She hadn't shared the details of her negotiation with the coach, but enough that he knew this was make or break for her. "I can only stay a minute," she said. "I really need to get back and prepare a few things." "Come on," he said. "Let's walk." He took her arm, and they went outside. He asked where she was parked, and when she told him which lot, he started walking with her in that direction. "I'll take you as far as your car," he said. "The rest is up to you." It was unseasonably cool out and overcast. She turned up the collar on her jacket. The coach seemed undisturbed in his sweats and t-shirt. "You know how people say it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game that counts? Well, that's close. But it's not just the how, it's also the why. If you know why you're playing the game, then even if you lose, you win. And if you forget why you're playing, then even if you win, you lose. Even if you win, you lose." Jillian tried to wrap her brain around that as they walked on. "If you don't know the why," the coach continued, "then I don't care how skilled you are. Genuine winning is impossible. Out of your reach. The why of sports is simple. To express excellence in motion." "And in business," said Jillian, "what's the why of business?" He turned to her. "Well, what would you say?" Jillian thought for a moment. "I would think it's different for everyone." The coach chuckled and shook his head. "No, it's exactly the same for everyone. It feels different, looks different, expresses itself differently, but it's the same thing. And it's simple, too. You go into business to nudge the world forward." Jillian looked at him. "That's it?" "That's it. To make the world a better place. Improve people's lives. Leave the planet a smarter, kinder, richer, more whole place than it was when you got here. To create value, which you do by sharing what you know, what you have, what you've been given. All business, whether each business person remembers it or not, is an expression of gratitude. Elizabeth put it perfectly. Gratitude is the secret to all magnificent success." They walked on. "You remember what I said about the difference between sports and business?" No, Jillian remembered. "Winning in sports is about competition. Winning in business is about collaboration." He glanced over at her, impressed. "Good memory. Well, that's not quite the whole truth. Winning in anything is really about collaboration. So here's another baseball question. Sadaharu Oh?" Jillian shook her head. "Never heard of him." "Japanese baseball star. Played in the Japanese Pro Baseball League back in the 70s. Holds the world lifetime record for home runs. That's the world record. You know what he said about the pitchers who went up against him on the opposing teams? They are my partners in hitting home runs." When you know what Sadaharu Oh knew, you'll know what genuine winning means. And then it'll come to you naturally. As they reached her car, they both stopped walking. "Good luck today," he said. "You'll do fine." He turned and started to walk away. "Wait," said Jillian. "What's the thumb?" "Hmm?" "You told me you could count everything you knew about winning in business in the fingers of one hand." She held up her right hand, index finger pointing straight up. "One," you said. "Breathe." She counted off on her fingers. "Two, listen. Three, smile. Four, be gracious. That's four. You can't hold a bat with four fingers or throw a football or shake hands on a deal. So, what's the thumb?" He cocked his head, then slowly nodded. "Smart kid." He backed away a few steps, still nodding, then turned and called over his shoulder as he walked back the way they'd come. "You'll figure it out." She stared at his receding figure, suddenly feeling panicked. "Wait!" she called out. He stopped and turned back to look at her. "How? How will I figure it out?" He reached one hand out in her direction, all five fingers outstretched. It reminded her of that odd gesture he'd made the first time they'd met at his office when he placed his outstretched hand on the desk between them. "Trust," he called back. He turned and walked away. When Jackson Hill arrived at Rachel's Famous Coffee on Friday morning and headed for the corner table, he stopped short. There was no one there. A moment later, a server stopped at his table, bearing a large tray. It was Holly, the first person he'd met there on Monday morning. "The judge sends her regrets," said Holly. "She said an emergency came up and she wouldn't be able to make it." Jackson's heart sank as he sank into the seat. Without the fifth clause, the rest is de facto null and void. He'd hoped that last bit of Henshaw wisdom might somehow rescue him. "And she told me to serve you this the moment you came in." Holly set the tray down, lifted off a plate of hot peach pancakes, dripping with real maple syrup, and topped with French vanilla whipped cream, and set it in front of Jackson. Jackson looked at the plate for a moment, then at Holly, then at the plate again, and started to laugh. She chuckled too, not knowing what they were laughing about, but happy to join in. "Thank you," said Jackson. Holly smiled. "My pleasure," she said. At his place, Holly had also set a one-stem vase holding a single white rose, and propped up against it a small envelope with a single word penned in neat calligraphy. "Jackson." He took the envelope and opened it. A small card slipped out. "Sometimes you need to just trust and eat the pancakes." He puzzled over the note for a full minute. Finally, he slipped the card back into the envelope and pocketed it. He began to eat, wondering why on earth he was sitting here eating a plate of pancakes, which, he had to admit, were delicious. As he took the last bite, probably the first full meal he'd eaten all week, he thought, a curious sense of calm settled over him. He didn't know why or how, but he was ready for his meeting.
Chapter 13, The Fifth Clause. Jackson Hill looked, well, he looked different. Different how? Mirabel couldn't put her finger on it. He seemed more solid, more there, like a man at peace with his own convictions. "You can go right in, Mr. Hill," she said. "Ms. Waters is expecting you." "Thanks, Mirabel," he said. As he walked past her desk, Mirabel leaned forward and stage whispered, "I hope it goes well." Jackson stopped and looked at her. "Thank you, Mirabel," he said again. "I hope so, too." Jillian felt flustered. She was trying to stay focused on her plan for this meeting, which she'd spent the last hour preparing for. But her thoughts kept drifting to an image of Marvin and Mrs. B serving their little kings and queens, and to Sadaharu Oh, whose face she had looked up online the moment she'd gotten back to her office. As if staring at the man's features on a computer screen would shed any light on what the coach had told her. When you know what Sadaharu Oh knew, then you'll know what genuine winning means. She pushed the thoughts away. Oh, she could breathe, all right. She could listen and smile and be gracious. But she could also be smart and do her homework. And she had done exactly that, which was why she knew she had this in the bag. So why was she still feeling flustered? Jackson took his seat and looked again at the photo on Ms. Waters' desk. "She's beautiful," he said. "Oh," said Ms. Waters, "thank you." Jackson looked at her, then at the photo again, then back at her. Then, his face a total deadpan, he said, and the human child's lovely too. They looked at each other for a prolonged instant, and then both burst out laughing. "I can't believe you said that," Ms. Waters gasped, wiping tears of laughter from her eyes. "Me neither," said Jackson, smiling. They looked at each other. "Well," she said, "shall we get on with it?" He nodded. "Sure, let's go." Jillian felt her heart beating in her chest. He seemed so calm, and it threw her. "Stay in control, Jill," she told herself. "Eyes on the prize. A signed contract in her hands. Not next month, not next week. Today." "I've put quite a bit of time into this the past few days," she began. Jillian had a secret weapon. Two, actually. Some enterprising staffer for the corner office had dug up a most interesting little factoid. "It seems our boy Jackson is in a rather precarious situation with his bank," the guy had said. "They're about to pull the plug, and by about to, I mean by close of business today. Disconnect the life support, scuttle the ship, hammer the for sale sign into the front lawn." She could practically see him drool when he said it. That was one. And two, incredibly, she had somehow finagled the corner office into giving her the okay on underwriting Jackson's kitchens. With stringent, read, brutal, conditions on how much he could spend on a significantly bare-bones plan, but still, a thumbs-up was a thumbs-up. She'd had to be persistent, and in the process had probably devalued her currency in the SVP's eyes. She hoped it was worth it. "The bottom line," she said, "is that I believe we'll be able to provide you with the underwriting you suggested for your production facilities, with some terms attached that you may not completely love, but still, it'll get the job done." Jackson Hill looked both surprised and impressed, but all he said was, "Wow." "And the whole issue of exclusivity," she went on, "well, that may be a sticking point, but I have some ideas on how we may be able to work around that and find some middle ground." Jillian could hardly believe it herself, but it was true. This was going to work. He needed what she had, and she had what she had. This was a done deal. Whatever resistance Mr. Hill might still put up to their terms, she knew it didn't matter, because she had the winning hand here. Right? And besides, this was the right thing to do. Not just for her, but for both of them. Right? But he was not acting like a man about to put up a fight. Not even slightly. It was clear to Jackson that she felt triumphant, yet at the same time, unsure. He didn't know how he knew that, he just did. He felt his heart go out to her. She was having a crisis here, that was clear. Not that he wasn't having one, too. "That's great, Ms. Waters," he said. He paused, not quite sure what to say next. "Jillian," she said. "Sorry? Please, call me Jillian." Jackson nodded slowly. "Okay. The thing is, Jillian, the thing is, it seems I have two options here. Go with your terms, the way your company has worked them out, or doggedly stick to my guns and risk losing out altogether on this amazing opportunity. For the past week, I've spent just about every waking minute trying to figure out how I can make this work. All week, I've been telling myself, no matter what they come up with, say yes. You've got to get this contract." He paused again, briefly. "But maybe that's not the right goal." He shook his head, a long, slow shake. "I can't supply on a national scale. Not yet. I'm just not ready." He looked at her. "And I can't justify giving anyone any kind of exclusive. I'm just not willing." The moment the words left his lips, it occurred to Jackson to wonder if Jillian Waters would think he was being tactical here, because what he just said sure sounded an awful lot like a version of the takeaway. But it wasn't. For a split second, the thought crossed Jillian's mind, he's posturing. He's got to be posturing. But in the next moment, she banished the thought. He meant what he said. She could see that. She could sense it. This wasn't a strategic ploy, a tactical feint, a negotiating technique. He wasn't trying to win. He was letting go. "What do you have that you love? Well, he had Solomon, Walt, Keith and Lily, and all his other friends. Fight for what you want, Walt had said. You are in the right here. But Jackson didn't feel like fighting, and being right didn't seem important anymore. Even if it meant stepping away from this contract altogether and going back to being just the guy making the world's best pet food in his own kitchen. It's just, he began, then stopped. I'm sorry, he said. At this point, I think I just have to let it go. I just have to let it go. As his words echoed in her mind, Jillian saw her future evaporating. No signed contract, no viable bid for SVP, no promotion, no corner office. Wait, though. She was still holding that juicy bit of intelligence on his bank loan in her back pocket. She could pull it out and dangle it in front of him. I have two options, he'd said, and he was right. There were just two options here, and hers was the right one. She knew he was over the barrel, and she could push on that point, hammer home what her company's signature could do for his future, show him that this was the right path to take, the only option open to him, really. He might just cave. She was sure they'd be able to work out some sort of compromise. Compromise. From the Latin, meaning nobody gets what they really want. Jackson stood, reached out, and shook her hand, calm and firm. You went to bat for me, and I really appreciate that. It's been a genuine pleasure almost doing business with you, Jillian. He'd made it all the way to the door by the time Jillian Waters found her voice. Mr. Hill, she called out. Jackson turned back. Jackson, please. Right, of course, I'm sorry. Jackson. She was standing now, too. She came out from behind her desk and walked over to face him. Jackson, she said, I'm just wondering. Jillian stopped, her mind going a million miles a second. Was she crazy? Once she went down this road, there'd be no turning back. I'm just wondering, she repeated. Could you wait out in reception with Maribel just a minute or two, just long enough for me to make a phone call? He looked at her quizzically. I'm just thinking, she said. Maybe there's a third option. The rest of the day was a whirlwind. The coach's philanthropist friend Elizabeth was as good as her word. Even on this ridiculously short notice, at the prospect of doing something special to help animals, the sweet, sweet creatures, as she'd put it, she was happy to meet with Jillian and the young man who accompanied her. When presented with Elizabeth Bushnell's signature on a piece of paper, Jackson's bank all at once became exceptionally polite. Extending the loan? Why, of course, that should not be a problem. What's that? Perhaps more generous terms? They were sure that could be looked into. Outside the bank, while Jackson hailed a cab for Elizabeth, Jillian turned to Elizabeth and said, You know, this is so perfect. Jackson never really wanted to be in charge of the business side of things, which is the part I love most. What he wants is to formulate the products and be in touch with the clients. Elizabeth smiled at her and said, It is a lovely solution. The best ones always are. Jillian didn't know how to put this in words. I can't tell you how very grateful I am, Mrs. Bushnell. Elizabeth patted her hand and said, You just did, dear. She pushed her glasses up on her nose, peered through them at Jillian, and gave an almost smile so slight you'd miss it if you blinked. And why don't you call me Aunt Elle? All my close friends do. At 5 minutes to 5 that Friday afternoon, Jillian handed in her resignation at Smith & Banks. She handed it, in fact, directly to the senior vice president of distribution, who was so startled that one of his subordinates was leaving ahead of his own more ceremonious departure that he failed to say anything but an unceremonious, huh? Best of luck, sir, said Jillian. I'm grateful for everything I learned here. She had, she explained, received an offer she couldn't turn down, going into business with Jackson Hill and Elizabeth Bushnell. As of today, she was managing partner of Angels Clothed and Fur, LLC.
For Jillian, though, as remarkable as the entire afternoon was, as much of a kaleidoscope of impossible events and memorable moments as it was, there was one particular point in the day that was still thrumming through her like an electric current when she went to bed that night, a moment she expected would stay with her for the rest of her life. As they'd stood there outside the bank, waiting for Jackson to flag down their cab, Elizabeth Bushnell had turned to her and said, "You know, you remind me of myself. A number of years ago, of course." "Is this me?" thought Jillian, 30 years from now. Well, now, she couldn't picture a more wonderful future than that. That night, Jackson practically fell into bed. It had been a long day. Huge, big in every way, possibly the best day of his life, but long, too, and he was exhausted. Solomon jumped up onto Jackson's bed, walked around Jackson's feet and over to his left side, where he collapsed into a large heap with a deep, "Oof." "What's up, buddy? You think you're sleeping up here tonight?" Solomon said nothing, just hitched his body up closer until he was smashed against Jackson's left side. Jackson chuckled. "I have a feeling one of us isn't getting a wink of sleep tonight." Solomon put his chin down on his paws and looked at Jackson. Jackson turned off the light and lay there. Tired as he was, he couldn't sleep. He thought about everything that had happened that day, about sitting alone at Rachel's famous coffee this morning, eating his peach pancakes. It's always helpful to see the other side. He sat up and switched on the light again, reached over to the light jacket he'd been wearing, and pulled out the envelope the judge had left for him. He slipped the card out of the envelope once more, turned it over. Sure enough, there was writing on the other side, too. It said, "Dear Jackson, I never told you the fifth clause. Here it is. Let go of having to be right. But I suspect you already know that. Celia Henshaw." "Sometimes you have to let go of having to be right," he said aloud, "and just eat the pancakes." He laughed quietly for a moment, then set the note down on the nightstand, switched off the light again, and rolled over. Within 30 seconds, he was asleep. "Woof," said Solomon.
Chapter 14. A Toast. The tall woman with the auburn hair looked across the table and smiled. She loved it here at Iafrates. Best food in town, as far as she was concerned. "Me too," said the man in the seat across from her, reading her mind as usual. "Although I am partial to the meals my wife and I make at home," he added. "Naturale o gassata?" The waiter had appeared at their table soundlessly, holding out twin bottles ready to pour. "Sparkling for me, please," the woman replied. "Grazie, Marco. And still for the coach." "Si," said the young man, who was already pouring. "Prego." He nodded once and silently disappeared. She turned to her companion. "A toast, Coach Henshaw?" "What are we celebrating, Judge Henshaw?" "The young man who is coming in for advice this week. I think he's found a satisfactory solution to his quandary. That he's on, you might say, a winning track." "Touché," he said. "To the young man." He looked at her, lifted himself out of his seat to reach over the table and kiss her, then sat back down. "And the young lady, and her young daughter, and all those sweet, sweet creatures whose lives they'll touch, and the people whose lives those creatures will bless. God bless us, every one, as Tiny Tim would say." The woman raised her water glass in a toast. "To dogs and cats everywhere." Her husband nodded. "Angels clothed in fur." He raised his glass as well. "To Jillian Waters and Jackson Hill and their myriad of munchkins. And their benefactor." "Oh yes," he agreed. "To Mrs. B, the lovely Aunt El." "And Pindar," said his wife. "Let's not forget Pindar." The man raised his glass once more. Indeed. Let's not. They clinked their water glasses together and said in unison, To Pindar.
The Five Secrets of Genuine Influence. 1. Breathe. Master your emotions. 2. Listen. Step into the other person's shoes. 3. Smile. Set the frame. 4. Be gracious. Communicate with tact and empathy. 5. Trust. Let go of having to be right.
1. Master your emotions. Breathe. Set your feelings to the side. You can still have your feelings. You don't even need to change them. Just set them aside for the moment. Don't let them drive the car. Put reasoned judgment in the driver's seat, feelings in the passenger's seat. Retrain yourself to respond to conflict and disagreement by unruffling your feelings. Make calm your default setting.
2. Step into the other person's shoes. Listen. Get out of your own head and step into the other person's perspective. See the world through their lenses. Appreciate where they're coming from and what's at stake for them. Listen with the back of your neck.
3. Set the frame. Smile. Take the initiative to establish the tone and context of the interaction. Whoever sets the frame of the conversation also sets the direction and tone in which it will go.
4. Communicate with tact and empathy. Be gracious. Let yourself feel what the other person is feeling and speak to that truthfully, yet also with compassion. No matter how different they may seem or what position they may take, remember that they are a chime and you are a tuning fork.
5. Let go of having to be right. Trust. As long as your premise is that your position is the right one and the other person's is the wrong one, you have no chance of arriving at a genuinely satisfying solution. Sometimes you have to let go and eat the pancakes. And, surprise, you may find you have what you let go of.
A Go-Giver Influencer Discussion Guide. Many of our readers have explored the Go-Giver books together in their book clubs, business study groups, houses of worship and community groups, or among friends and family. The questions below may be helpful in guiding your discussion of the Go-Giver Influencer.
1. When the story opens, what do Jackson Hill and Jillian Waters each want in their lives? Do either or both end up getting that? If not, why not? If so, how so?
2. What impression did you form of Ms. Waters when you read Chapter 1? Did that impression change as you read Chapter 2? If so, how did it change and why? Did you step into her shoes? Is there anyone else, aside from Jillian, about whom your view changed significantly in the course of the story? Is there anyone in your personal or business life that you felt one way about at first, then found your opinion changing as you got to know their situation better?
3. In chapters 1 and 2, there are hints that Walt, Jackson's father, and Craig, Jillian's former husband, may have had an influence, albeit a negative one, on how these two approach their business dealings. In what ways do those influences show in their thoughts or behavior? Have there been people in your life who have had this kind of sway over how you behave?
4. In Chapter 3, Jackson marvels, for the 100th time, that he and Keith are such good friends despite how completely different they are. How many other odd couple pairings of two opposite characters can you find in this story? How does that contribute to the story and its underlying message? Do you have any such opposite friends?
5. In chapter 3, Keith tells Jackson that he needs to learn some tricks and tactics. A few pages later, Walt describes one such tactic, the first of 5 in Walt's bag of tricks. The flinch, the challenge, the compromise, the stall, and the takeaway. At any point in the story, did you notice Jackson or Jillian attempting to use any of these 5 ploys? How did it work out for them? Are there any similar tricks and tactics you've ever used yourself, whether in business or in your personal life? How did it work out for you?
6. In Jackson's phone call with the judge in Chapter 4, when she asks what outcome he is after, he describes his problems, and she turns that around by asking him to describe what he truly wants, that you love, that gives you joy. In what ways does that simple shift foreshadow the ultimate course of the whole story? What about your story? What is it that you love, that gives you joy?
7. In their first meeting in Chapter 5, the coach warns Jillian that learning about his winning strategy will change the way she thinks. Does it? If so, how? What happens as a result?
8. In Chapter 6, the judge tells Jackson, "Every dispute is first and foremost a dispute with yourself." Can you see examples of this idea right here in this chapter? Can you see any examples of it in your own life?
9. In Chapter 6, the judge claims that in making calm your default response setting, you become more you. Do you think this is true? If not, why not? And if so, why and how?
10. In Chapter 7, the coach tells Jillian that effective boxers, snipers, and CEOs alike all put the majority of their energy and focus into listening rather than acting, be it throwing a punch, taking a shot, or making a decision. How would this idea apply to persuasion, negotiation, and influence? How might it apply in your own line of work, in your personal life?
11. In what ways is the advice Walt gives Jackson in Chapter 8 parallel to the directive Mr. Corner Office gives Jillian in the same chapter? What is the essential position they both recommend taking? How do you think Jackson and Jillian each react?
12. In Chapter 9, the coach quotes a friend. If you've read The Go-Giver Leader, you probably recognize that friend as Aunt L, as saying, "The substance of influence is pull, not push," and then goes on to talk about keeping the back door open. What does keeping the back door open have to do with the principle of pull, not push? Can you identify situations in your life when someone has left the back door open for you, or where they've slammed that door shut? Examples of where you've done either one yourself.
13. In Chapter 9, the judge says, "Whoever sets the frame of the conversation also sets the tone and the direction in which it will go." Going through every scene in the book, one by one, can you see who sets the frame in each and how they do it?
14. The meeting in Chapter 10 does not turn out well. Can you identify the precise moments at which it starts to go off the rails? Exactly what it is that goes so wrong in each of these moments, and why? What could the two have done differently, if anything? Why didn't they?
15. In Chapter 11, the judge says, "Empathy is the single greatest determinant of success. Not only having empathy, but also communicating it." Do you think this is true? Why? Or why not? In the same chapter, the coach quotes Mrs. B as saying that gratitude is the secret to all magnificent success. Do you think this is true? Why or why not? Thinking of highly successful people you've known, do you see an especially high level of empathy and/or gratitude in them? How would you assess your own levels of empathy and gratitude?
16. In chapter 12, the coach says, "If you know why you're playing the game, then even if you lose, you win. And if you forget why you're playing, then even if you win, you lose." Does this make sense to you? If so, why and how? Can you identify examples from your life of both situations?
17. Comparing Jackson and Jillian's meeting in chapter 13 to their first encounter in chapter 1, can you identify the ways in which the later scene echoes the earlier and the ways in which it is its opposite? In what ways have these two people changed in the interim?
18. Who do you think is the influencer of the title? Why? You could make a good case for a handful of different answers, each one valid in itself. And here's an interesting one. Could it refer to someone whose influence is felt throughout the story, even though neither Jackson nor Jillian ever meet him, and he doesn't even appear, at least not in person, in the book? All of which makes one ponder the nature of influence and what causes its reach, and also prompts this question. Do you suppose there are people whom you have influenced, even though you've never met them?
Q&A with the authors. What led the two of you to write this book?
After the Go Givers publication 10 years ago, we had such a good time going on to apply the Go Giver idea to sales, Go Givers Sell More, and leadership, the Go Giver Leader. The natural question was, what's next? The theme of influence played a central role in all the Go-Giver books, as well as in Bob's how-to book, Adversaries into Allies. And it seemed to us that in these highly polarized times, it might be helpful to explore a Go-Giver approach to influence, civil discourse, and the ability to see another's perspective.
In both the Go-Giver and the Go-Giver Leader, there was one protagonist and one mentor. Here, there are two of each. Why?
The Go-Giver influencer is at its heart about the importance of making the effort to see and acknowledge other people's points of view, as different from our own as they may be. It seemed only natural that our hero would not be one person with one set of circumstances and experiences and a singular point of view, but two very different people. This naturally led to the idea of two mentors and two sets of principles, different but complementary. The theme of this book is about bringing differences, even opposites, together into a harmonious and productive collaboration. Two-ness becoming effective oneness. So in the end, as our particular Jack and Jill go up their hill and come back down as business partners, we also get to see their two mentors dining together, married, as it turns out, and even the two sets of principles, the coach's 5 secrets and the judge's 5 clauses, combined as one integrated set.
The judge calls her approach natural negotiation, and the story itself is about a business negotiation that happens over the span of a week. Would you describe this as a 1-week course in how to be a Go-Giver negotiator?
Yes and no. We actually thought about calling the book that, the Go-Giver Negotiator, that is. So, yes, the principles here can most definitely be applied in situations of negotiation, whether it's a business deal, a child trying to get her parents to buy her something she wants, or 2 nations attempting to come to terms over issues of state. But we didn't call it that, for 2 reasons. First, we didn't want to confine the book's message to scenarios of conflict resolution. The principles of genuine influence are a good deal broader and apply to so many other kinds of situations. And second, the term negotiate is itself intrinsically negative, deriving from nego, meaning the lack or denial of, and otium, meaning leisure, boredom, wasted time. Denial of leisure equals industriousness equals business. You can see how the thing evolved. Not that it's a bad word. It's a fine word. We just didn't want to make it our headline. Today the term negotiate has come to have the connotation of something narrow and pointed, even ruthless. To get your way, typically by the skillful swordplay of clever tactics and catchphrases. To vanquish your opponent in a duel. En garde. We wanted to navigate a different path. One based on Pindar's paradox. The more you give, the more you have. A way to achieve your goals while making the world a better place. The word that best captures that path, to us, is influence.
In Chapter 5, the coach has a pretty dismal view of compromise. Isn't compromise a good thing?
Yes and no. In some respects, the art of graceful compromise is essential. No relationship, business or personal, can long survive without all parties involved having the capacity to soft-pedal their own needs and demands and accommodate the other, at least to some extent. The word, after all, means to make a promise together. The problem comes when adopting the idea of compromise as the path of least resistance, a fallback alternative to pressing on towards a more fruitful solution. In the kind of compromise the coach is talking about, both parties give up on achieving their own true objectives out of a sense of futility. Since neither sees a pathway to a genuine win-win, both agree to settle for a sort of lose-lose. The classic example of this we-give-up compromise is the story of King Solomon arbitrating a dispute between two women who both claimed ownership of the same baby. You know how that went down. Happily, Solomon was able to discern which woman was the real mother, and they didn't have to follow through on his proposed compromise, which was the whole point of his little ruse. Woof. Alas, many contemporary divorces, business acquisitions, and lawsuits lack Solomon's wisdom and do end up splitting the baby in half. Nobody wins. Ouch. The worst kind of compromise is when you compromise a core principle. Honesty, integrity, loyalty, truth, family, and so forth, for the sake of expediency or some other more base consideration.
When the coach says manipulation might sometimes win the game, but it never wins the game, Jillian says, I have absolutely no idea what that means. I'm with Jillian. What does that mean?
Let's face it. People do sometimes get what they're after through manipulation, just as it's possible to win a game by cheating. What the coach is saying is, while that might work in the short run, and we stress that it might work, because it often doesn't, and the manipulation just blows up in the person's face, it never provides a long-lasting or deeply satisfying win. It's said that crime never pays, neither does manipulation. Yes, a crook might get away with a crime, but it typically exacts a terrible cost on the perpetrator as well as the victims. Or, look at it this way. You may win an argument or close a deal through manipulation, but at what cost? Jillian could possibly have strong-armed Jackson into signing his life away to Smith & Banks, but if she had, where would they both be now?
When the judge tells Jackson he has to learn to set his feelings to the side, doesn't that make you inauthentic? Isn't it crucial to stay true to our feelings and be our true selves in every respect?
We're not saying you should suppress or deny your feelings. Not at all. We're saying just don't let them rule your decisions and actions. Yes, your feelings are an important part of you, but they are not you, or at least not the whole you, and not even the most reliable or true you. Feelings and emotions can be highly volatile. In other words, they can change rapidly and unpredictably. It's not that they aren't real or aren't important, they are both. But they're not the best aspects of yourself to put in charge of steering your course. What is? As the judge puts it, reasoned judgment. Of course, the reverse is also true. Applying reason and logic without consulting your feelings can be disastrous too, because your feelings can often provide critical clues to what your intuition is telling you. Think of your feelings as your board of directors and your reasoned judgment as your CEO. Yes, you want to consult your board on every important decision, but the CEO ultimately needs to be the one making that decision.
What does the coach mean by listen with the back of your neck in Chapter 7?
Before we try to explain this, let us say first, try it. The next time you're listening to someone speak, imagine you're using the back of your neck to hear. It's a weird experience at first, but an interesting one. It's like you're trying to hear with not just your ears, but your blood vessels, nerve fibers, and all your cells, which is essentially what you're doing. It's similar to the expression, read between the lines. It makes no literal sense. There is nothing between lines of type, after all, but white space. But it does make sense. It's like listening not only to what a person says, but also to what they don't say, what they mean, what they're feeling behind the words and facial expression. It almost sounds like telepathy, but what it really is empathy.
The judge talks about stepping into the other person's shoes, and that's one of your five principles. To me, the phrase makes it sound easy, but how do you actually do that?
You're right. It's a great metaphor, easy to remember and repeat, but not necessarily as easy to implement as it sounds. What if the person doesn't wear the same size shoes as you? Then you literally can't step into their shoes. This is a great question, because you don't want to be glib about this. It's easy to nod and say, I see what you mean, or I know what you're going through. But is that really the truth? Most of the time, we can't really know exactly what the other person is going through. Every person is unique. In a sense, it's impossible to truly step into another person's shoes. Yet, we can try. And even if we can't place ourselves 100% into the other person's perspective, we can come close enough to make a crucial difference. As the judge says, you and the other person are both human beings. You resonate with everyone, no matter how different from you they may seem.
When the judge talks about setting the frame, isn't this pretty much the same thing as manipulation?
It depends on state of mind, and especially on the frame setter's sincerity and motivation. As Judge Henshaw says, you have to mean it. For example, look at how Jillian, Ms. Waters, that is, sets the frame in Chapter 1. When the judge deconstructs it in Chapter 9, it becomes clear just how skillfully she did it. And yes, to us, that seems pretty darn manipulative. Now, compare that to the Abraham Lincoln vignette the judge describes in Chapter 9. The difference, as the judge points out, is that Lincoln was completely sincere. If you examine Jillian's comportment in Chapter 1, you'll see that she really wasn't. She was posturing to gain the upper hand. On the other hand, look at how Jillian sets the frame at the start of their next encounter in Chapter 10. This time, she is utterly sincere and authentic. And now the nature of the frame she's setting is quite different. Ironically, it's Jackson who resets the frame here, and in a fairly inauthentic way, with disastrous results. Finally, look at how Jackson sets the frame in their third meeting, in Chapter 13. Authentic? Sincere? Effective?
When you say, let go of having to be right, that sounds like not having the strength of your convictions or being wishy-washy. What if you are right?
We're not suggesting you diminish the strength of your convictions, not even a smidgen. What we're saying is take a deep breath and put your trust in the greater outcome. Start from the premise that there is an outcome that works for the good of all involved. Yes, you believe you're in the right, and you may very well be. Or you may very well not be, or not entirely. None of us is infallible or omniscient. But set that conviction aside for a moment in service of the communication itself. It's like setting your feelings to the side, not letting go of them,